Don't ever, ever be afraid of work and working hard. And I mean very hard, because it makes you noble. It makes you feel noble. It makes your family feel noble. It makes God feel noble. And not be afraid of anything, because with patience and perseverance, you could conquer anything.
Welcome back, everyone, to the X Factors to Success podcast show. This is Ruggiero Fratacangeli, also known as the G-Man. And thank you for listening in today. And those of you who are new to the podcast, we focus on five key principles that we call the circle of the letter F. Circle of Fs. Faith, family and friends, fitness, finance, and fun. And all our guests that we bring to the show bring forth their experiences of life, their journeys, and how they achieve success. So without further ado, allow me to introduce to you our new guest. I have the honor today to bring a guest to you that also has published a book, his memoir, and it is now the second edition, possibly going to a third edition. Before I introduce this guest, let me just give you a little bit of background of the book that he has written, which is very inspirational and motivational. This gentleman here takes us on a journey beginning with growing up in pre-World War II in Venice, Italy, where he paints pictures of the struggles and joys of growing up in the island city, only to have his life torn apart by horrors of the World War II. It's a story of love, courage, and persistence that demonstrates that if you have the will, anything can be accomplished. This includes his torturous migration to the United States of America as an illegal, and his constant desire to achieve the American dream, a home, a marriage, and a college degree. And of course, this second edition, going into possibly his third edition, walks us through what most of us would consider challenging odds. He played many roles in his journey. His name is Emanuele George Scalco, and I'm live here at his home, that's right, at his home, with his lovely wife, Marie. And also, we have one of the four children, beautiful daughter, Beatrice, who will be joining us live today as well, and sharing the journey and the experiences to achieve success, along with all the memoirs and experiences in his book, Leap of Faith. That's right. His book is named Leap of Faith. And please welcome Emanuele George Scalco. So George, welcome.
Thank you.
So George, this is going to be a very casual conversation with your beautiful wife, also Marie. She's going to chime in as well. And I've got a couple of things that I'm sure our audience would like to hear your story. And I did mention about a book, which we'll get into. The book called Leap of Faith, and of course, a memoir of yours that you recently published, a second edition, matter of fact, not just the first, but also a second edition. And let's just start by, tell me more about you. Why Emanuele George Scalco? As an Italian, you have the name George. Just start with that.
Well, I'll tell you.
Tell me.
I was born.
When I first came here in 1950, I sort of, quote unquote, jumped the ship in Philadelphia.
You jumped the ship? Literally jumped the ship?
It's not jump. I walked off with much difficulty.
Okay.
Because my chief officer intercepted me before I left the ship. I wasn't supposed to do that. But in any case, I just, how I got my name George was that I spent the night in a shabby room, and the following day I was supposed to meet a gentleman whom I met in the truck. And the truck was a theater, which was not
where the ladies
best,
come in.
You know, a ladies' theater.
Mm-hmm.
And that I joined there with the rest of the crew from my ship. And so we had agreed to that I would go to his restaurant where he worked. And it was called Giuseppe's Pizzeria on 9th and Washington Avenue in mm-hmm. South Philadelphia.
South Philadelphia, wow.
Mm-hmm. And so after spending a horrible, I think it probably was one of the most horrible nights of my life, not sleeping at all and being scared to death that I would get picked up by the immigration,
Oh, so hold on one second. So you came here illegally, you jumped ship. That's what it means, right?
Yes.
Let me explain, yes. Like they say.
Explain. I like that.
Let me explain.
You see, Marie? He's explaining. Okay.
So, as you know, when you're a merchant marine, so that's what I was, a merchant marine.
Good.
An Italian merchant marine company. You normally have to have a passport to be a merchant marine.
Understood.
So, literally, I didn't know it at that time. So when I got off the ship, I was here legally because I had a passport. But the illegality came when I sojourned here. In other words, I stopped here and I wasn't supposed to. I was supposed to get back on the ship and leave.
Mm-hmm.
So, however, to get back where we were, is after I spent that bad night, I ventured to go to Giuseppe's restaurant to meet Louis. His name was Louis Borriello, a very, very nice gentleman originally from Naples. And when I met him the night before, he said that he came from Naples, but he jumped the ship himself 6 months prior to that. And that's why he told me, why don't you stay here, George? I'll find you a job, and I love it here. It's great. And
so let me ask you, how did you know it was George already established? Your name was Emanuele.
No, I know. I'm getting lost here.
But it's okay.
So while I was trying to find myself to Giuseppe's pizzeria, I did not have a map. You didn't have one of those...
I'm sorry, you didn't have one of these modern telephones with the map on there, like an iPhone?
No, back then? Unfortunately, because now they're a mess. But in any case,
yes.
So
while I was trying to find my way, I had to ask people as to how to get there. So I started from close to 8th and Spruce. By the way, Spruce Street was sort of a red line district at that time.
Okay.
I didn't know it.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And so I started walking down 8th Street, and then I made it right, I think it was, on...
You're getting very detailed now. Wow. Pretty impressive.
Do you want me to?
No, go ahead. Please.
So in any case, I made it right, and I went a couple of blocks because he said it was on 9th Street. So I proceeded then south, and... just didn't know where to go. So I saw a gentleman that seemed to be, somewhat amiable.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I had a little grammar book with me, which was about 3 inches long and 2 inches wide. And some of the direction from the grammar book said, whenever you encounter an English speaking person, you first say, how do you do? So I went to the gentleman and said, how do you do? And he said,
oh no,
with the Sapphire Alpha dialect, what'd you say? And I said, how do you do? He said, no. Here we say, son of a bitch.
Yeah, I see that, read that in the book also as well. Yeah.
So I said, I repeated it, so I wanted to be sure that I knew it. I said, son of a bitch. And so he sort of told me how to get to 9th and Washington Avenue.
Right.
And I left them, and then about 5-6 more blocks, I got to 9th and Washington Avenue, and the pizzeria was on the southeast corner of 9th and Washington Avenue.
Okay.
And I would never forget it, because there was a double door, and I slowly walked in, and immediately I saw a very large man sitting at the bar.
Like
the bar was square, with one of
here he is.
So one.
By the way, if you're not watching, I want to know our video. La Signora Marie is imitating this big, large man at the counter. Go ahead, Mr. George.
So one side of the bar was up against one of the wall, the south wall, and I proceeded toward the man, and I said, "Son of a bitch." And so at that time, he just got up. And he was massive. He just got up and started yelling. And I didn't understand what he was saying, but he was just yelling. And so after a while, I
started to cry.
I started crying.
Okay, yeah, I got emotional. That's okay.
He scared me to death.
Uh huh.
And then
so there was a lady there by name, found out later, by name Giovanna, probably around 45 years old, dark hair, curly, and with glasses. And she took me to a little table that was on the side, and apparently she was a waitress.
Right.
So she sat me down, and she talked to me for a while. I found out that she was speaking some Italian to me, you know, because I was under this strong impression that everybody in the United States only spoke English. Mm. I didn't know enough.
Like many others also, George, right? Like many others thought that also English was only language.
I didn't know it was a mouth pot. And, so she quieted me down a little bit, and so I tried to explain to her that Luis Borriello asked me to come and meet him here, that he might be able to get me a job. And the big man got up and he said, but I found out his name was Joe Bucci, B-U-C-C-I,
mm-hmm.
and he was the owner of the pizzeria. And he got up, he said, there's no one here by that name. And so again, he scared the heck out of me. So I went back and sat down there, and Giovanna said, pigli un poco di caffè, get a little bit of coffee. And I didn't like coffee at that time, so I refused. And waited and waited and waited. So I was thinking to myself,
what are you going to do?
My God.
It's okay. There, continue on, George. You are bringing the emotions of those days. But look at what you have today—a beautiful family. So we're gonna continue on. I know. I take
so
you
said,
taking you back there. Go ahead.
I have no one here, you know, the ship is going to leave today. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? But finally, with the grace of God, Luis Borriello appeared from the back. There was a kitchen in the back. He came through the kitchen and he said, Emanuele, you know. I said, Lui, oh my, I said, you know, Dio mio, I said, finalmente.
Hmm.
Finally, he came out. And so he explained to Joe, because my thinking was that Joe thought that I was really a setup man for the immigration, because at that time, President Eisenhower was rounding up, you know, gave the order to round up a lot of the immigrants, illegal immigrants, and they deported something like, well, the order of 30,000 at that time. So that's what I think Joe was thinking, that I was from the immigration. But in any case, then Joe seemed to be fine. He started smiling a little bit. And, you know, I can never forget him, because he was sitting at the bar and he had a very, very large glass of Coke. And he was sipping that Coke. You know, he really enjoyed it.
So back then, George, Coca-Cola tasted very, very much, much richer than Coca-Cola today, right?
Oh, Coca-Cola, molto dolce.
Molto
very,
dolce.
Very sweet.
Very sweet in Italian. Go ahead, George, continue on. And then we'll get to the part where where the name George came about.
So I have to go backwards to do that, because when I was encountered that man, when I got lost, so he said, you know, what's your name? And I said, Emanuele. And he said, how do you spell that? And, you know, the word spelling doesn't exist in Italian, so I was trying to understand as to what he was saying, the spell. So I said, well, and I thought about the little book that I had on the ship where I read about the, you know, the founding of the United States, and I remember George Washington. So I said, George.
I love it.
And he said, okay. So then when I got to the restaurant, they said, Emanuele, no, George. So it was George from there on in. So my wife calls me George, our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, so I'm George.
Super, awesome. I love the story. Thank you for sharing with us. So let's get a little bit more deeper now. And again, we're going to go because we have a good solid 45 minutes of time here, so we could put in all the great highlights here. So you came on a Italian merchant marine ship.
Yes.
Okay, so we get that straight now. That was like 1950, is that what year was that?
1950, yes.
Beautiful. Was it a cold day? I know, I understand from the book, though, it was a Christmas 1950?
Yeah.
No.
When you got off.
In Christmas Eve of 1950, it may have been the 23rd, but I think it was Christmas Eve.
Okay.
From 1950, the first time we landed in the United States.
Oh, this is the first time?
In Baltimore.
Okay, so not the where you jump ship and
that was my second trip to
okay.
the United States.
So again, that straightened out. Very good. Okay, good. So tell us about this experience, because I, you know, in the book also that you experienced snow, it was cold, and you know, you were not very equipped with your, you know, jacket and so on and so forth. Tell us a little bit about that, because that was interesting also, because coming to America or visiting, so just give us a little highlights there, George, regarding that first experience coming to America.
Start. Let me tell you quickly how I got there. Is that okay?
Go right ahead.
Well, so I left Venice around the middle of 1950, and actually it was around August. And from Venice, we went south through the Adriatic and then the Ionian Sea,
beautiful.
And then we went west into the Mediterranean, and we stopped. Our first stop was in a city named Sfax. It was in Tunisia, so it was south of Tunis, in the Gulf, and there we were there for 4 days. We picked up ammonium phosphate, which is a fertilizer.
Also, it's a whole merchant of merchandise that you were shipping to different parts of the world.
Yes, we picked up some phosphate, and from there, then we went out into the Mediterranean again, went through the Strait of Gibraltar, and then via south and a little bit west, and we stopped to refuel in Senegal. So we did not stop on land, we stopped it on the bay, and they refueled us in the bay. So we didn't see anything about Senegal. And then just 7 hours later, we proceeded west towards Brazil. But nobody told us where we were going.
Yeah, no idea, no plan at all.
No.
But before you continue on, can you tell the audience, what were you doing in the ship? What role do you play? I read about it, but give us a little more so we can also imagine some of your endeavors, because this is all going back, going forward now to this George name, meaning Luigi, working at the pizzeria, you know, jumping ship. So I know we're going back a little bit, but what were you doing? What was your role?
Well, I have to tell you, this is important, very important to me.
Yeah.
My dad could not get a job.
Okay. And this was back in Venice, right? In Venezia. Yeah.
After the war.
So by the way, folks, sorry, George, you hear, folks, we're having now a wonderful, wonderful lecture on geography and knowing all the parts of the world. You see what George is explaining here? So Venice is a beautiful, beautiful city of all canals, right? I know.
Absolutely. And 475 bridges.
And he knows exactly how many bridges are there. Beautiful.
Plus or minus one.
Okay. George, continue on now of your dad, of your father. Okay.
So my dad, after the war, you all probably know that the Italians were on the wrong side of the war. You know, the First World War, they were on the right side, and they were victorious with the Allies. Now they became stupid, and they got on the wrong side of the Allies. And so Italy lost the war, you know, thanks to Mussolini and Hitler.
Ooh, okay.
And
sad times.
There were lots of bombings and lots of things, you know, that's innumerable to tell you, because most of them were really...
Yeah, not...
sad stories.
Yeah, sad story. Loss of life, and of course, loss of the country's integrity. And
So my dad couldn't get a job. because most of the Italian ships were sunk by the Allies, as they should have. And the rebuilding of the ship, Italy was not allowed to rebuild ships quickly.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So in Venice, most Venetians were either sailors or fishermen. So my dad was out of a job, and we were four children. And then in 1947, my mother passed away. And so my dad couldn't find a job.
Mm. Hard times. Yeah. I can't imagine.
So he found it easier to find me a job. Is an extra number on the ship. So there were 32 people there, and I became the extra number.
George, can I pause? What was the name of the ship, just in case anyone listens to this also?
It was Pietro Orsero, who was one of the famous dodgers of Venice.
Beautiful. Go ahead.
And they gave me a title. It was Mozzo di Cucina.
Can you explain that in English?
The rag of the kitchen.
Oh.
So there were three rags on board. There was for the deck, for the engines.
Yes.
And I was the one for the kitchen. So I was a good rag.
Well, you played a very important role, as I understood also from your book there, huh? Because that was critical.
So to get back, so do you want me to pick up in the Chesapeake Bay? Then, so we went across to Brazil.
Okay. Yes.
There is in northeastern Brazil.
This is your first time now outside.
First time outside Venice. Wow. Yes, outside.
What were you thinking? What was your feeling inside when you landed in Brazil? Right? Was it São Paulo, Rio de Janeiro?
It was actually the most northeastern state of Brazil is called Pernambuco State.
Okay.
Pernambuco, and the capital is Recife. They call it. We say Recife here.
Recife, okay.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful port city with a wonderful bay and just gorgeous, gorgeous.
Have you gone back to that port ever?
No.
Okay. No. That was the first time on the ship here.
First time in Brazil.
Okay.
First time in Brazil, and I can never forget it because right before I got there, I was getting melancholy on the ship.
Okay. Yeah.
I was feeling sorry for having done it.
But your father gave you the opportunity to get a job on that ship to work and bring back money back home, I guess, right?
Yes, but he also gave me a letter.
Oh,
my dad.
Okay.
Now, he didn't encourage me to go anywhere, you know, stay anywhere, but he said, there's a letter. If in case you ever go to America.
Oh.
I have a cousin in San Francisco. His name is Juan Scalco, with a K, S-K-A-L-K-O. And he's there, and he has a small factory where he produces maritime ropes.
Okay.
And
so you continue on the legacy of what he experienced back in...
Right. And I said, and of course, that's what I was thinking about, that I was going to America. But so then we got to Recife. So Recife... But before getting there, I was getting melancholy already, you know, during the trip across, because it was 7 days from Senegal. You know, the name of the city was Dakar.
Dakar.
Dakar is the capital, I believe. And so it was a long trip, and I got a toothache, and then I had a stomachache, and I was melancholy.
Mm. So from there, you went up the coastline into...
We went to Recife. Then we went south to... So we unloaded half of the ship of ammonium phosphate. Then we went south to Santos. Santos is the port of Sao Paulo.
Okay.
So Sao Paulo is inland. So we went and we unloaded the rest of the cargo in Sao Paulo, or Santos. It's a very, very large port. You know, there were about 300 ships, I think, on that port. And, mm-hmm. and I ventured down and right by the ship there, there was coffee about 2 inches thick on the ground. So Brazil was a, didn't realize it was a coffee country.
Yeah, big production.
There was coffee all over the place, right. and nobody picked it up. And if you weren't in Italy, everybody would be on their knees picking it up because of the poverty that was there after the war, right? So, and from there then, we stayed, I think, a couple of 3 days maybe, and then we went north to Rio de Janeiro. In Rio de Janeiro...
Now, do you deliver any merchant from there to next
from
stop?
Santos?
Yeah.
To Rio de, no, we were empty.
Empty, okay.
We were empty.
All right.
So we went north then from Santos to Rio de Janeiro, and I got off the ship, of course, because Rio de Janeiro, you know, the Ipanema, and of course, I learned all those things afterwards.
Okay.
The beach was just unbelievable.
It's okay, George. This is rated PG, yeah. It's okay. I could bleep things out if you have to say a couple of things, but this is, you know. So.
Well, I did a few nebulous things there.
Yeah, and the person who's going to pick up your book is going to read about it also as well. Okay. So they could imagine also the things that go on in those ports and those cities, right?
But Rio de Janeiro, we actually loaded the ship with iron ore.
Iron ore.
In Brazil, there is a lot of iron, and so we picked up, and there was a danger about that because iron, as you know, is very dense. So, and if you don't separate the cargo in the hull, then if it shifts, then the ship could go down. So you have to make boxes to put, you know, large boxes where you prevent the cargo from shifting back and forth when the ship rolls. In any case, from there, then we stopped in Trinidad to fuel. So we left Rio de Janeiro. And
that's another tropical island.
It was just beautiful, yeah. But of course, we just refueled like as we did in Senegal,
yeah,
and then proceeded up north. We didn't know where we were going again, you know. They just kept the crew in the dark, so to speak.
Yeah, but
and,
it was Christmas,
excuse me,
it was Christmas.
Well, we finally got up the coast, and it was adventurous to go up the coast because
we're fast forwarding now into this 1950 Christmas time, right? Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, but
okay, so.
Going up the coast, though, there was, you know, the when we got up after the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf Stream was right alongside our ship, you know, or we were alongside the Gulf Stream.
Sure.
So I could just look at all of the different fishes and all the vegetation that went up with the Gulf Stream, you know, as
sure.
You know, it goes up, you know, alongside the United States, and then it veers to the east, and it goes all the way to the British Canal. You know, that's why the countries are a little warmer than they should be there, because the Gulf Stream goes
sure.
Over there, even into Iceland, believe it or not. You know, it's incredible.
Interesting.
So in any case,
okay.
We went up, we finally entered the Chesapeake Bay. I didn't know what it was, but I found out pretty quickly, and the Chesapeake Bay is extremely long. It's
I've been there.
Several hundred miles
yep.
long, at least. And then we stopped, and everything got cold. I mean, everything got, so cold that the winters were frozen.
Major shift now on the warm climate, right? Into
yeah.
So, surprise to you, right?
And the winters were frozen. You know,
so, take me a little bit into I got that. What was your emotional experience? What kept you motivating? I want to hear more of that motivation. Were you thinking back home? You were melancholy? I want to get that kind of sense. I want to feel that.
Well, the motivation was that I didn't want to let my father down.
Yes, you had a mission.
I didn't want to go back as a failure, right?
Right.
So I persevered.
Amen.
In other words, I respected my father with the utmost.
Of course.
And I didn't want to be a failure. So, but we finally got up to Baltimore, and as I said, it was Christmas Eve, and I only had the only suit I had made, and you know, people in Italy get suits made, and because it's cheaper than buying them in the store at that time.
Tailor-made suits, right, George?
Yeah,
amazing.
The tailor was just down the street, and the first time I got suit made, except for my first communion.
Okay.
So, and it was a beautiful, I love that suit. We only got rid of it about 30 years ago because we kept it for a long time. And it was shark skin and a double-breasted single beautiful. Button. You
know, yeah, I've seen some pictures. It's on your book there as well. Look, you're a handsome gentleman there.
I don't know.
And you still are.
I was a kid.
A young gentleman. It's okay.
Yes, we were going up the Chesapeake Bay, and as I said before, the winters were frozen. It was very, very, very cold, and I had only that suit. I didn't have anything that was winter-like clothing. But I was so eager to get off the ship, and but I had a scarf.
Oh,
I had a scarf.
Thank God you had a scarf.
That was very good.
Was it an Italian scarf, George?
Yes.
Good.
Yes,
thanks.
It was.
So good quality.
Well, maybe. And anything after the war was not good quality.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
But in any case, got off the ship, and normally, whenever we got off the ship, I always followed, because since I was the youngest on the ship, I followed the lower crew, you know, because not the officers, you know, we were.
Mm.
But when I got off there, for some reason, I started seeing people, and they were smiling a lot, and they were dressed so well. And the women had corsages on their lapels, and they carried presents. And
so stay right there.
They greeted each other with a lot of smiles.
So was this something in contrast to what you left in Venice?
Yes, in Italy at that time, after post-war, people were very somber.
Yes.
You know, they just.
And so now you're here watching
the war. There was nothing else but the war and the afterwards. You know, so here now I see everybody smiling and well dressed and greeting each other. You know, just I'm sure they were not related, but they greeted each other anyway. You know, so,
right, Marie, right.
So at that point, I just I said, "This is the country."
So at that moment, you had this revelation.
Yes.
And you had snowflakes. Was it snowing also?
It was snowing, but lightly. It was snowing lightly. And there were row houses not far from the port.
Okay.
And there were lights in the windows, you know, so unlike in Italy, you know, we never had that at that time. And I just said, my God, this is, you know, I remember reading the book Pinocchio. And when I was a little kid, you know, and that they went the land of jolly and plenty, you know, and that's what it looked like.
So this
it
was like a
it was like a fantasy
land. Fantasy land.
Like,
that's the word I'm looking for.
Real.
Wow.
It wasn't real.
Wow.
But it was.
Yes.
It was. You know?
You had to pinch yourself, right? You're like, am I really here?
I was, and I said, I knew that it was cold, you know. So I knew that it was. I knew it was real, but
in your beautiful tailored suit, right? With a scarf.
Yes, and everybody probably thought I was crazy, you know, walking around.
Oh, you were a handsome young man right there. Walking.
Heavy jacket. But, so that was the first impression was the best impression, really. That's the,
and you still...
No, I've gotten many, many best impressions afterwards, you know, while I've been here for so many years now. But
so if you don't mind me asking for the audience here, how many years you're in this wonderful country, the United States of America?
Since 1950, so it's now
there you go.
73
so folks,
years.
You heard that? Since 1950.
73 years.
Yeah.
Incredible.
So let's fast forward. This is a beautiful story. We're going to continue on. We want to tie this in also with the understanding how motivated you are. You have resiliency. You have courage. And this is not easy today. People say it's hard life and so on and so forth. But then you met this wonderful, wonderful person next to you sitting right now as we interview right now. You can't see, folks, but you started working, right? Going back to Luigi, right, who now gets you to work. This big guy, Joe Bucci, and he put you to work. He thought you were, again, illegal immigration, so on and so forth. But you start working.
So he said, he did. He said, I give you a job.
Oh.
And I didn't understand everything. He said, but I understood the number.
Italiano.
$18 a week.
Oh, hold on one second. $18, folks, this is 2023. If you listen to this podcast right now, it's August of 2023. And this is $18 a week back in 1950. And what kind of work was it?
I was always good in math, you know. So at that time, the dollar was worth 660 lira, okay?
Oh, yeah, that's right, lira.
So in my mind, I multiplied 18 by 660. And it was
plentiful.
Three times the pay that I was getting
at the ship.
Three times the pay that I was getting on the ship.
And how many hours of duty on the ship?
16, 17, 18.
My God, you heard that?
I never did over 18, but I didn't require sleep. I never did. I still don't.
Yeah, I understand that. On the book, I hear like you hardly sleep 4 or 5 hours and good to go.
Now I sleep 4 or 5, and if I sleep 6, I feel like a prince. But I feel like a prince anyway.
So now you're making $18 a week.
$18. Yes. So I multiply by 660. It was
that's a lot of money.
A large amount of liras, you know.
Liras, right?
In that. Didn't know any better because the same day, Louis took me to find a room.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You had a place to stay.
On 10th and Wharton.
Those of you who are from Philadelphia,
Between Wharton and Reed on 10th Street.
I wonder if it's still there.
On the western side. On the third floor, it was a very shabby room, you know, but the room was $11 a week.
Oh, hold on. You're making $18 and your room is, that's a lot of money for a room. But still, you still have more money.
Well, you know, there was...
He did what he had to
do. You know, after...
All right.
After realization, it was not too good because we were not allowed to eat in the restaurant. We were not allowed to eat.
They didn't feed you at all?
Well, once in a while we got a sandwich, but it wasn't like you had a dinner or something like that. So... then we learned, Louis and I learned to to buy a quart of milk and put it on the windowsill because it was still cold. And then I learned to eat white American bread.
Oh, hold on. Not Italian bread, folks, but white, like Wonder Bread? Is that what you like that?
Actually, what was the name of the?
Bond bread.
Bond bread.
Eat bond bread because bond bread makes you better bodies. And that's an ad right there.
Bond bread was a block and a half from Marie's house.
Oh,
the factory
was there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we used to do that, and then we found out that Bologna, we call it here, was the cheapest
meats, cold cuts.
Cold cuts that you could get. At that time, I think it was something like.
Cents.
28 cents a pound, something like that. It was very, very
abundance.
So we got that, and we used to keep it because the landlady didn't want us to use the refrigerator. So we put it on the windowsill.
It was cold?
And it was cold at that time. So we made two sandwiches a day, you know, with double bread.
Wow, double bun bread.
Yeah.
Bond bread and bologna, B&B.
Two like slices that. On each side and two slices of bologna.
You see, folks, you can't hear Beatrice laughing right now. She's the first daughter who was born there, I guess, right? Right. See, I'm jumping ahead here, but she's laughing about eating bologna.
You think it's really funny. But it was funny to me, too.
Oh.
We were eating.
You know? You're surviving also, right? So, beautiful.
So in any case, we got this room, and so I realized immediately... You know, I didn't know anything about economics, but it came through very quickly.
You learn real fast. Survival.
So we got the room, and the next day I started working. And Joe Bucci said, I couldn't speak a word of English, but I had 4 words. You know, how do you do? And then another one, thank you. Yes. Right?
Okay. Yeah, that's a good start.
I knew no, too, because it was like Italian.
Yeah,
like,
no.
I said no. He said, no, he said, no. I said, okay, no. But, so he told me, you're not going to work in a restaurant, you're going to work in the frozen pizza place. And I said, frozen pizza place? First of all, when he said you're going to be a pizza man, I said, Joe, I never seen a pizza in my life. You know, in Northern Italy, there were no pizza.
Oh, hold on 1 second. This is a good point here. In Northern Italy, that time, no pizza?
No pizza.
Because the pizza came down from Napoli, right? From down south.
Yeah.
From southern part of good, hey, good cultural thing, folks. Hear that? All right.
But the warm pizza, George, just said that.
Nevertheless, frozen pizza in 1950s?
Well, this man was, you know, even though I first disliked him because he was ominous.
The big man, right?
Yeah,
Big Joe.
He invented this.
But I found out later that he's got a patent on frozen pizza. Anyway, I think it was the very first, and he was challenged by someone else. But I looked it up. I looked it up lately, you know, while writing the book. So he has a patent on that. But about a half a block away from the pizzeria on Washington Avenue, on the south side, right in the middle of a block, there was a sort of a very large garage. And at the end of it, it was a freezer that I never seen anything like it as large as that. I never seen one afterwards either, you know. So but they over there were large pots all the way around, and there were 6 or 7, 8 people working there, mostly young. And
any immigrants like yourself?
I was the only imported job.
You were imported.
But all of the people there were absolutely nice to me. They just
They embraced you into the group.
Yeah, they respected me, but nobody knew I was a jump ship except Louis. Louis worked there too. So we worked together.
And the plot thickens, folks. And the plot thickens.
So I learned pretty quickly what pizza was all about, and he was the first frozen pizza maker in the country, I guess in the world.
He's an entrepreneurial, this guy.
Yeah, and he distributed pizza to A&P, which was a large chain at that time.
I'm from the New York area. A&P's.
A&P and Pan Fruit was another large chain. Mm-hmm.
So you worked at this. You worked at the frozen pizza section of his business.
Yes.
Impressive. You learn really quickly. You learn how to.
I had to learn quickly. I wanted to, and I had to.
Yeah. Again, going back to your promise to your father, Giovanni, right?
Yes.
I'm kind of saying right now because you were determined to be here and work hard and send money back to. Back home, right? Back to your country?
Yes, not initially.
Not initially, okay, gotcha.
But the pay on the ship, I never took any money from my pay. It went directly, it was telegraphed home directly. So all of it, you know, even I worked overtime quite a bit, and although we got paid only half the time that we put in for overtime, you know, our union was not like the unions we have here, right? And I made some money helping the first officer to sell cigarettes illegally. So I used to hide them for him. So I got some money, and that's how I used to, when I went
okay,
out.
So you hustled up a bit also.
Well, I don't hustle. I didn't know what the word hustle was.
Well, and today is the 21st century today. You know, those who are listening, hustling. But you were entrepreneurial, let's put it this way.
I helped. As we say in the South,
you know,
I helped.
You know, George, what happens in the past is the past. I understand that there's a lot of things that obviously we've done in the past. Things are forgiven, so on and so forth. But you had to do what you had to do. You know.
Yeah, and then sometimes they used to give us a couple of bottles of Chianti.
Oh.
You used to sell that on the black market, like in San Francisco.
You mean like Carlo Rossi, like the old Italian gallon of wine?
No, Carlo Rossi is American.
Yeah, I know that. That's why
it was Chianti from Tuscany.
Tuscany, okay. Oh.
Chianti wine with the straw bottom.
Yes.
And the Brazilian just
I have a loved I have a bottle at home right now, just sitting in the corner with the straw bottom.
Loved it, and then there were on board. We also had. Nylon stockings.
Yeah, I read that also in your book. Nylon stockings was a big thing also?
Oh, after the war, there were no nylon stockings. Oh, no. It was an American thing. So the women, oh my God, you gave them a pair of nylon stockings, that's it.
Wow, you got them. You can marry them.
You were it.
No.
seriously, if you just, like in Hamburg.
Hamburg, Germany.
You know, one of the guys went on the side and he got the stockings and waved them. and the women from
wow.
Oh my God, it was incredible. So wow. There were some things, American
okay.
cigarettes,
okay.
Italian wines, and stockings, you know, women's stockings that were just gold.
So you made extra money with those things, right?
Well, I want to send all of the money home.
Okay.
I want to do that because my dad was working sort of a part-time job as a waiter, and before he was a maitre d' on the ship, you know, so he had a nice big job when we were young. We really did pretty well.
So George, I love the story. Love it then and now. I want to bring your beautiful wife into the picture here, because I want to fast forward and now.
Please.
You continue on now. You work at this pizzeria, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. What was the name of the pizzeria again?
Joe's Pizzeria.
Joe's Pizzeria. How did you meet this beautiful?
Giuseppe's
Pizzeria. When did you meet Maria Valenti? When did you meet your beautiful wife? How did you meet her? Give us a quick little story there.
I didn't meet her for a long time.
Oh.
I used to go to school, and my other friend came with me.
Teresa.
Okay.
And what happens?
Go ahead.
I went in front of the window.
A window? Well, he was making pizza in front of a window?
Yeah.
Okay.
Later on.
Yeah.
He was making pizza. So I said,
you.
And then we ran off.
You were courting him.
No, they were laughing at me.
Oh,
they were laughing.
Because this Italian guy making pizza, swinging pizza.
Like a monkey.
You mentioned that in a book. I found it to be interesting. Like, okay, but again, showcasing, right?
I was ashamed.
I understand.
I was shy, and I just. And all these people, and,
Are you shy? I don't think you're shy now. No.
A little bit.
Okay. Well, you obviously she saw you from the window, and she had something in your eye. Yeah, a handsome young Italian.
Yeah, she didn't like me.
Marie, let me go to you. I know you
like me,
Marie. Marie Sacco, Marie Valenti Sacco. You what were your thoughts of kind of checking out this Italian boys? Were Italian boys off the boat accepted back then? Was it?
No, I like to tell you when I first seen her. I mean, that's very, very important.
Yeah, go ahead, go. So tell me.
All right, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Marie, but the first time I seen her, you know, then we got another room with
Louis. You upgraded now.
We downgraded in price.
Oh.
So instead of paying $11 for a room by myself, we found a room across the street from Marie. I didn't know she lived there at that time. From a name, an old lady named Geraldine. And so we got a room and we slept together with Louis.
Okay.
To save money.
Sure.
And
roommates.
So, and what we did, we didn't know what to do, you know, we wanted to be inconspicuous because we were always afraid to be picked up from the immigration.
Oh, there you go again, being jumping ship.
So one day we were talking to a couple of old ladies right across from where then I found Marie.
I was in the shoemaker store with a friend.
Yeah.
And somehow or another, I felt something was doing to me in the window. He was looking in the window. And I says to my friend, let's go.
Are you a shy too, also, Marie?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I turned around and I went home. And then again, he started to walk on the curb. And the curb was... The curb was round. Okay. And I figured I'd never see him again, right?
But deep down, you did want to. Yeah.
Yes. So what happens is he comes over to the neighbor next door, which I was still in the shoemaker.
Okay.
And what he said to the lady, what did he say? What did you say to him?
I looked at you, and there was Louisa, who lived a couple of doors away from me, Vigilante,
yes.
Was next to you. And I looked at you, and I said, marry her.
I must
really?
Marry her.
So I said,
you knew right away.
I knew it.
The colpido, it gave you right into your heart.
I just knew it.
So what happened? Every time he comes around, I would be on the other side of the street.
She was playing hard to get.
Yeah, you play hard to get. You and your friend are saying, oh, what a handsome, but he was a handsome. Well, he still is. Yeah, yeah.
Well, he had his bago things on. So.
Wow. Okay. By the way, you can't see Beatrice, but she's laughing also as well. By the way, Beatrice was born in Philadelphia also, I believe, right? Yeah, so.
Well, I was blessed with, somebody gave me a pair of pants, you know, because his name is John Calabro. He gave me a pair of pants because he didn't want me to look Italian, so I won't get picked up. And
you'd be more Americanized.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was the whole thing. Okay.
So he gave me a pair of shoes. But I looked at her and I said, I'm going to marry her. But Marie did not want to go out with Italian boys because she had enough of Italian people around her.
Oh, that's right. Back then, no, sure.
Right.
So that's why every time I went down the street, she went on the other side of the street.
I was afraid because I was young then.
Okay. And so you were afraid also what your parents would say too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, back then.
Well, she learned about the curfew, so.
Oh, curfews, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happens is.
No, she was afraid because if I go home with her mother to see her mother,
yeah,
immediately the parents said, okay, Marie, you're going to get married, right? Because in those days, you know, Italian parents would try to get their children married.
Yeah, you want to go have fix the whole thing. Yeah.
The thing was, my sister had twins, so we went and put my mother on bus on 39th Street. 29th Street.
He's correcting you. Look at that. See?
And so what happens is, we come home, and my father. This was Christmas time. Christmas time.
Okay.
And what happens is, I said, "Mom, we're going to go home." So I said, "Okay, let's go." So we got back.
They used to go out to her sister to help. Now I persisted with the twins because they were really little.
Okay.
Yeah, so what happens is, I turned around and said, gee, you know, my father was in the kitchen and I was coming in the house. And my mother, too. So they all offered him a drink because, you know, he offers him a drink because everybody.
What kind of drink there?
Told Marie that a man came to the house, an Italian man came to the house.
Oh, so this is the.
Yeah.
And she, what did you think when you said that, Marie?
I said, what? I said, I don't know anything.
Oh, yeah, denying now, right?
Right?
So she was so upset.
It was him. He brought the shirt for me, bought a shirt for me for Christmas.
What a nice gesture, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. How dare
she said, "How dare you?"
Oh.
I said, when I saw him the next time, I said, "How dare you that you do that to me? I'm in my house with my parents. You didn't give me a chance
you see,
to."
Yeah, what an Italian man!
You.
What a true Italian man, bringing embellishing you, giving gifts already, whatnot. Mm-hmm. So he was working. He was working. A smart man. Smart man, and look there. By the way, can I ask you, 65, 70 years married? 65?
69.
Folks, did you hear that? 69 years marriage. When did you celebrate the 69th?
In April.
April. 25th. So, yeah. April 2024 will be 25th. Will be the 70th. That's a milestone.
Yeah, but we have to make it first.
We'll have it.
You'll make it. The way I see you right now here together, folks. I love you. I love you very much. You know what? I love you both. I love you all three of you, by the way, unconditionally. Okay, because I'm hearing the story, and folks, yes, I say it with grandeur. Because folks, those of you who are listening on the show right now, you're probably hearing all the details from George and Emery also. Scalico, and you're hearing something of chiming in from Beatrice, the first daughter of four children that. They both have. But the fact that you listen to these stories, and they're very, very deep because it goes back to the memories, which gives them the love they have right now, the love and courage and all the embellishment they have given to their family and the grandchildren. I think you have about 22, 23?
We have eight grandchildren.
That's right, I'm sorry.
And four great-granddaughters.
Oh, great.
And one grandchild on the way. And we hope it's a boy.
You want more boys in the family? Wow. Okay. So here's the deal, man. I love the story, this romantic story. You move forward also. I know there's a lot of more details in here. We could be here for hours and hours and hours. But if we could fast forward, as I understood from the book also, mm-hmm. you had to get married. So you had to get some kind of legal papers here, right? And you had to go through some process. Yeah, I think you had to go to somewhere up in Virginia, right, to submit some of the documentation.
Well, I have to tell you that nobody knew anything about that. We've done one wrong thing in our life.
Oh, it was top secret. It was secret.
Yeah. No one knew.
My grandson
found
it in the book.
Beatrice's son, Mike.
He was the only?
He was dabbling in genealogy about 2 years ago.
I saw that. And he discovered?
He found it out, and I almost killed him.
Yes.
And the secret was unveiled, right, Beatrice?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. So
the story is, though, that we were always afraid of getting caught. And after Beatrice was, we're just afraid that we get caught.
Sure.
And, so with the help of Tom Spera and John Quattron, his friend,
okay, who are the, hold on, we're giving these names, give us a quick brief, who's Tom Spera?
Tom Spera is a gentleman that we met in Mara's Pizzeria.
There you go.
With his friend John Quattron.
Now, hold on 1 second, I'm going to interfere right now. You have Giuseppe's Pizzeria and now you have Mara's Pizzeria. This is the second
this
job.
My second.
Good, job. Okay, go ahead, continue on. Who was the other gentleman you mentioned?
John Quattron.
Okay.
And very, very nice people, you know, and Tom... I still love him. Wonderful, wonderful man. And so we had a long discussion. Then we included Marie with that because he said, you don't want to get caught and then you have to go back to Italy. Because if you could not pay your way back to Italy, you went back as a prisoner. And I could just imagine my father seeing me coming back to the prison.
You don't want to disgrace your father. Okay. No. Okay.
So, after long discussions, we decided to, as they say there, run away and get married.
Eloped. Eloping, right? Yeah, that's the word, right?
And the gentleman, Mario D'Adamo, who was the son-in-law of the owner of Maris.
It's amazing you remember all these names.
Of course.
Of course.
How could I forget them?
Just like you do.
So Mario D'Adamo and his wife Bianca, who was the daughter of the owner, Salvatore and Christina Mara, drove us to what we thought it was Elton, you know, because somebody said the closest place where you could get married illegally, I mean, not illegally, but,
quickly
is Elton, which is at the interface of, the state line between Delaware and Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay.
It was the closest place. But then I found out, I was convinced, and we were convinced for many, all of these years, we're talking about 70 years, we were convinced that we got married in Elton, but it wasn't. I guess we were both busy at that time, obviously. And
do you have those documents? Do you have those documents, though?
Yeah. We wound up in Virginia.
I have them.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had to research that because there was confusion. But Louis Borriello,
okay,
dad drove Louis Borriello and his intended wife to Elkton.
Okay,
they got married.
And Maria
there.
And I drove them there
in the
Monday.
Same month. So I think they were really just so distraught.
Yeah. So the urgency to get to legality here, and you don't want to go disappoint your father back in Italy. And you obviously you love this one woman that we have right there for 70 years now, and the fact that you had to do what you had to do. That was the times.
Yeah, but we talked it over with John and I said, this is really wrong.
Oh, so you felt a little bit of a...
Oh, awful.
Yeah. Oh, okay,
but
well...
then we said, we decided, we're going to consume our wedding when we get married in the real sense.
And the Catholic Church has understood, right, also?
Later on.
Yes,
that was in 54 now.
Okay, I see. We're still in 54. We're not even 2023 right now, right? Okay, so this is the foundation of what we're talking about right now. So success, right? We're going to stop right here for a second.
Yes, sir.
This level of success, what would you attribute to? What would
That was not success.
Hold on. You mean apartment, you know, working at the Giuseppe Pizzeria, work at the frozen place was not a success?
No, I tell you, Ruggiero, I was living in a reign of fear.
I understand
day
that. See that? And that's where people who listen to right now are saying, is it about the fear factor that made you move forward and motivate you?
Yes.
Right, Marie?
I just didn't want to get caught and go back and share my father. That's
okay, so you had integrity. Integrity, respect, principles.
I guess that was.
Because you have faith, family was very key for you, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And you respected that. And your financing. Okay, you see how we're turning it all in right now?
If I want to interject for a second, I would have never left Venice if my mother was still alive.
Okay, and your mother's name,
Beatrice,
as your first daughter.
Absolutely,
first child.
And my wife allowed me. No, she actually chose the name for Beatrice.
Beautiful.
She was wonderful.
While we're at it right now, you have four children. You have three daughters.
Yeah,
three daughters. I'm Lisa,
boy.
Maria is the youngest, and John was the third.
Okay, good. All right, like me, I have four children of my own. I've got three boys and one girl, a little opposite than you, but I'm not married 70 years yet. I'll get there one day.
Be patient.
Yes. I'm learning more and more every year that goes by. Patient. I'm on my 24th year. I have a long way to go.
Patience
is true. So, for me, and I'm listening to you, it's success. Because you're describing yourself, you have principles and values in order to do what you needed to do. And unfortunately, by this discovery of this ancestry discovery from the family member, happened to find something that you felt maybe somewhat very uncomfortable.
Well, there was an upended the whole family, you know, me especially.
Yeah, it upended
well,
you.
Is it because, now I'm going to tie this in, is it because of your religious beliefs also?
No, it's because I didn't want our children and grandchildren to even think about doing something like that.
Oh,
I didn't ever. And,
but those,
I was thinking that we were setting a bad example.
But those were different times, though, right? There were different times,
shame
Beatrice.
That was
yeah, it was a shame.
That
you
was
could, you had to cover up. Okay, I understand.
Yeah.
I understand. You know, we have things in our closets. All of us having things in our closets.
Yeah.
Sometimes we don't disclose. But look here. You have a beautiful family, and they're very encouraging. But I want to take this to another level right now, if I may. And I know that you moved forward also. This is some trips back in Montreal, Canada also. You had to go some legalities. You came back. Life continues on. Now, I want to go to a part where you started going to school. And I want to get, because there's many people out there who are listening right now. Say, yeah, school. This is back in the 50s now, right? No, 50s,
yeah, but,
maybe early 60s, right?
But yeah, when that happened,
right.
I told my father and my mother what happened here. So what happened was, I said, what do you want to do, he said.
To me.
To you.
Because now he's committed, right? Committed?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, now you have to...
I know.
You have to say they know why we started going to school.
Yes, okay. So...
That was Beatrice.
Because of the firstborn.
We had our first child, and
You want the better, also
I was
opportunity.
Saying, I still had the Italian mentality at that time, and in Italy, it was always bella figura,
which means
you have to look good all the time. Yeah. And if you have a bad job, you always tell people that you have a better job than you really do because you want to look
the social status.
So I said to Maria, I said, our little daughter is going to grow up. And somebody's going to ask, what does your daddy do?
Hmm.
We were thinking. He said, my father is a pizza man. And I said, we can't do that, Our daughter has to be proud of what we're doing.
Yep. That's another motivating factor.
And
family.
And that was the turning point. So I owe we owe it all to Beatrice.
Yes.
Because okay.
So we decided that we're going to school. So when we were saying this, he went to our dad and said, Dad?
Dad, he would like to go to school.
There you go.
And he says, yes, he can go to school. And
we were living with your mom and dad at that
yes,
time.
Okay. We were living with my parents. And I said, and he said to make me forget now. What do you call his name?
What would you like to do?
Yes. And he said.
I said, I'd like to become a physicist.
Now you knew right away you wanted a physicist? Or you just kind of read it?
I was green as green can be. I just was fantasizing or something.
I
didn't know.
No, you needed, as I understood, you needed also a high school diploma in order to get to college, right?
Absolutely.
I know. So this is a school thing. You had to accomplish. But your English was challenging.
Very. It's one of the most challenging things.
So you had to work in school and work, all those hours you worked, as I understood?
Well, when we decided to go to school then, not to finish, I guess the important story is that Papa Valenti said, physics? He said, I take a physic every month.
Oh.
He said, excellent salt.
No. Okay. I that's a chuckle right there. Okay, bravo.
That's what he said. I couldn't laugh because
no respect. Sure.
Yes, do physics.
I guess
so. So he said, Marie, you know, we look at the BB, you know, and
she was little
at that time, right?
It was
1957.
He's disclosing your age now, Beatrice. Yeah. Okay.
57. She was born in 55.
That's
around
what
57.
It is.
She was a couple of years old, and we watched the baby. He said, we watched the, you know,
the
me
baby.
And Liz, we watched the baby, and you could stay here in our house, you know.
That's what you used to do also, you know, the family will, you know, the parents will take care.
But you're right, you know, I didn't have, you know, I quit school when I was in the middle of the eighth grade.
And by then, I would think, schooling in Italy was a little bit more also regimental also, so you learned a lot too. You had a basis of education, I would say.
I think so.
That's what
I already had 2.5 years of Latin. And in the sixth grade, we started geometry, believe it or not, plain geometry.
Which here in this country, you know, and in study schools now, you don't get geometry in sixth grade.
In the eighth grade, we had solid geometry.
Yep.
And we had the beginning of algebra in the seventh grade, you know. But I was a poor student. I just, I didn't like school.
Mm.
That's why I quit. I made an excuse up.
I made
the excuse that I have to get a job to help my family. You know, it was really... It was all like a Duncan experiment.
Again, back then in the late 30s or early 40s during the war, it was a whole different situation.
Yeah.
So let me interject here. So you eventually got your high school diploma, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we went to Lincoln Prep. We found a school on 20th and Chestnut.
Okay.
They called it a prep school.
Prep school, okay.
And most of the people there were veterans.
No, from World War II, right?
Yes.
Sure.
So there were a lot of veterans at that time, you know, and that was a wonderful school for me because, you could get a high school equivalency, as everybody knows.
Yes.
And that means that you could take the state board exams, many exams as you want to, as many times as you want.
As long as you pass.
Even if you fail, you could take them over and over again. And so... So I accelerated getting the high school diploma because I used a lot of the stuff. Like I had a course in physiology, I remember, in the eighth grade in Italy.
Okay.
And guess what? I took the exam and passed it. And then I took 4 years of Latin.
And this is all in English.
In English it was terrible. For me, English was always terrible. Yeah. That's why I tell everybody, whenever somebody comes up to me, you know, when I first came to the South, first person that I came across, they said, what's your name? I said, George. You know, and I said about four words, and the person said, Where y'all come from?
Yeah, well, that's the same thing happened to me.
I come from here. He said, but y'all have got an accent.
Yeah.
I said, have you got an accent? I said, well, can you spell anti-disestablishmentarianism backwards like I can? And the person said, what's that? You see what I mean? You have an accent.
Wow.
And that's how I handled it.
But by the way, when we talk about the South, I guess right now, as the time of this recording, this audio, we're in North Carolina in the Raleigh area. So so North Carolina was, again, I know we'll get there in a second, but obviously the whole Southern accent is definitely...
I love dialects.
Yeah,
definitely.
So now, George, from this high school point, you went to the high school equivalency while working also? Is that what you did?
Yeah, I worked 12 hours, 3 to 3.
Three?
6 days a week.
3 in the afternoon?
To 3 in the morning.
That's pretty impressive. Wow, wow, wow. And how did you study? You studied after work, right? Is that what it is?
Whenever I could, but when I went to school, I tried to be on the first row so that I could listen to the professor and take everything in as much as I could, because I had an almost, not quite, but an almost photographic memory.
Like I do. I that's the way I studied also in my high school years, college years, is photographic memory. Even reading your book is photographic. I know that those chapters that you wrote also in your memoir, you know? So I feel like a part of your life, you know, and today definitely is coming to fruition. So let's fast forward now. You accomplished the goal. You got your equivalency. Now, you said you want to become a physicist?
Yeah.
Yes, but I didn't know what it meant. You know, I wanted to do some type of
engineering,
technical stuff.
Okay. And where did you end up going for your higher degree? Because I understand in the book you went to a college that's pretty famous out there.
Well, Drexel was It was actually a college.
Drexel
Institute of Technology. It was not a university yet.
Oh, so this is
1958.
Okay.
1958.
Okay. Why did you go there? Because of technical school, close proximity to where you were living?
Proximity, and John Quatron told me, you know, because he actually went to college, John Quatron.
Oh, this is the other friend now, okay?
Yes,
okay.
Tom Sperr's friend,
okay.
Closest friend. And, you know, we talked about that, and he said, Drexel. He said, you know, Drexel is extremely difficult.
Oh.
And I said, I want that.
Oh, you took a challenge.
Yes, he took the challenge.
No fear.
You couldn't.
Because you had an American dream.
I couldn't be fearful.
Okay.
I couldn't.
Okay.
It was not in the vocabulary.
Non-negotiable.
Right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And so you entered. Now, I know I want the audience to listen to them, because you didn't get into Drexel very easy, because you insisted and persisted a number of times. Can you give me a short version of how did you get into the school? How did they accept you?
Well, they, we went to, well, first of all, they did not accept me.
Oh, okay.
They did not accept me.
That's right.
Normally they said no. So, and I said,
Because of the English language?
Well, I had 30, I never had 30 of anything before, you know, it was 30 in English.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was 33.
A score and 30. So because of your entrance, okay, I got you now.
You know, it was bad. It was just bad. Mm-hmm. And so they told me you could never make it here. You know, just so no. So I said, well, you know, no.
No means?
That's the word, you know.
Okay, so, I love that.
So, and we went there. First I went by myself. I went back, you know, every other day I would go up there. You know, and,
you annoyed him. You went every other day.
But I was nice about it and very humble, you know, of course. And no, that's funny. I said, I'm gonna take Marie with me, you know.
Oh.
And I said, the piece of resistance, right? Marie. Marie doesn't do it, nobody can.
Oh. See, Marie had lots of faith in you. Look at that. You are the foundation here, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I got that, okay?
So we went up there together, and they said no.
This is the first no?
Or
the second no? Or third no?
Oh, there was like
a lot of no's.
It was umpteen no's.
Oh, my gosh.
At least seven or eight no's.
You heard that, folks? You heard that, folks? This man here, her nose.
He's not going to get it.
And you know what? He did not want to accept any nose. Right. So go ahead. Now?
So I think it was probably maybe the 11th, 12th time.
Okay.
And I said, I have to do it. I have to do it.
Because of family?
Yes, I wanted to provide a better living for our family and be our kids and my wife to be fine.
So hold on, kids. Hold on. Is Beatrice the only child right now at this time? Or
we,
you have...
we had a... Well, let me see. No. Beatrice was the only one. Because Lisa came in 1959.
Okay.
Beatrice was 1957 and 8.
Okay.
So, several times. And then one time, they say Nord again. And there was a dean name by name Galfin. He looked like a bulldog. He was a strong man, you know, and just he seemed to be very erudite, you know, a very smart man. And he said no. Then there was a gentleman. They were, you know, they had sort of an assembly. They got together to say no. They were the same.
So this is a panel. Yeah.
That was the admission.
Admission. Okay. Yes.
So. Then one gentleman, I remember his name was Yabensky or Slovensky or something like that.
You could visualize that. I can see you closing your eyes and visualizing him.
Yeah, he was sort of medium height and a little on the heavy side, and he just and he came out to me, you know, because I was out of the meeting, and he said, "Listen, I think you have a lot of dedication." He said, "I'm going to go back in there and see whether I could convince you."
Oh, interesting.
And he came out, and they came out and said, Dean Galfin came out. He said, "Okay, we'll accept you at Drexel, but I guarantee you that in less than 6 months, you'll quit."
Because of the hard academics curriculum?
I could never, He said, "My English was bad. I couldn't make any of it, but I was pretty good in math, you know."
That's your forte, right? Math, geometry, and things like, as you mentioned earlier. Okay.
And he said, "Yes, I just, you know, my God, I was euphoric, you know. I just ran home and."
And you went to your wife and said,
"Oh my
great
God,
news.
We accepted."
And you give her a big hug and big kiss.
Oh my God!
Okay,
yeah,
good.
I picked it up.
Oh, celebration! Yeah.
Yeah. Picked it up. I went home and on that. So
did she cook a dinner?
Yes.
No, at that time, Marie didn't cook because her mom. Was
okay.
The chief.
La signora Valenti.
No, she would say to Marie, "You watch me. You stay right here beside me by the stove."
Uh-huh.
And she would never let her cook.
Okay. Well. Of course. It was her kitchen. I know that. Yeah.
She memorized everything.
Beautiful. So you celebrated, and now you enter school. You entered Drexel.
That was a short celebration. We just said, hey, we're going to school. Yeah.
So let me ask you, how did you, part of the X factors to success is finance. And finance is very important. You need financial stability, whatnot. Give me a short thing also.
The short.
Yeah.
And the long of it is that Marie worked at Broad and Lehigh for Joseph Cohen's and Sons. They were tailors. It was a Jewish family.
Uh-huh.
And Marie's brother, Salvatore,
yes.
Or Sal, and we call him Zsa, and he worked there as a pants foreman.
Pants foreman. Pantaloni.
He was incredible. He could make you a pair of pants in 2 hours. And they fit you like no pants has ever fit you before.
Custom pants.
It was incredible. He was gifted. In any case, so... And he's got Marie a job there, and also his brother, Dominic, he's got a job.
Oh, the family, working at that location, okay.
Yeah, he was a presser there. So Marie worked in the office. And she was making, at that time, I think, $28 a week. And then later on, she made $35, a couple of years.
Very nice,
you know?
Back then.
Yeah. So, but there was the credit union there. That was the key.
That was your financial kind of...
I didn't know what it was.
Oh.
And it took me years to find out what a credit union was.
So you took loans as far as to...
Oh my gosh, here we go.
Okay.
We ran them dry. We just...
Okay.
You know, I know at the end, very shortly, at the end, on my fifth year, so we went to school full-time the first year and 6 months per year in 6 months in industry, and Drexler found you a job. Okay?
Well, so you enter this intern job type of thing.
It
also
was called a co-op.
Co-op, okay, yeah. Co-op course. So, yeah. Now, well, how did you feel? Tell me how you felt as you got into this whole school thing. How did you really feel during this process? Now,
I thought I was scared to death all the times. Okay, yeah. Because you went to school, and I was older.
You know, older than the other students in the class.
Yes.
In I used to call them kids. You know, director.
So six, seven years old. You're older, like 6, 7 years older than them?
Yeah, they were about 18, and I was 24, 25. And they...
it reminds me of me.
I
went to school also later also. Nevertheless, though, was an experience. The experience gave you more of a cutting edge, though.
I don't know about that because, you know, those kids were phenomenal. They just retained everything, and they were boom, boom, boom.
But they didn't come from Venezia. They didn't come from the ship. They didn't come from that port that you came onto. They didn't work at the pizzeria. They didn't work at the frozen pizzeria, George. No. They didn't work at the Mamara's pizzeria.
But that was no excuse. You know, those kids had already had calculus and differential equations. Some of them had differential equations in their fourth year of high school. So they were really equipped, you know, just... and not only that, to go to Drexel, you know, it was tough to get in, you know, because I never forget my entrance exam, never as long as I live, you know, okay? I could relive it every day, you know. But they were so sharp, and I was so slow, and I couldn't talk right.
You know? But you made it through. So let's fast forward now. You made it through. You had this co-op operations also. You were working, also got a job. Would you make money also during going to school?
Oh, yes. That was very, very
helpful. You went around. Go ahead.
No, Marie, go ahead. Yes.
No, he went around when the...
Go ahead.
Well, what Marie is trying to say is that there was a question as to where's the money going to come from. You know? So finally, I had to quit Maris. And I was doing a banquet waiter work.
That's the waiter position,
you know,
I mentioned before,
out of
right?
The union.
Yeah.
Out of the union. So I used to go, you know, every afternoon after school to get a job for the next day because sometimes they had breakfasts, or sometimes they had dinner, and then weekends, you know, bar mitzvah.
Of course, weddings and dinner dances and stuff like that.
Right. So yeah. I used to pick up any job they could give me so long that it didn't interfere with the school, right?
Sure.
And then finally I got a job at the Bellevue Swafford Hotel, which is one of the finest in Philly, on the second floor. And there was a private club called the Variety Club International.
It's amazing you remember all this.
And it was run only for the purpose of having actors and actresses who came to town with
those
plays,
yeah, okay,
or people who won
the Hollywood stars and who's who in a social
and the people who won movies and theaters in Philadelphia. So they belong to they were the members of the club. These people from the theater would come in, you know, after the theater was
over,
like 11 o'clock, and they stayed there until 3 o'clock closing time, and that's when I worked. So I went up there at 7:30. He stayed there until 3 o'clock, then went home, and then Marie's mother, I had a little study room upstairs. She come up with a hot dog. And say, Georgie, Pina, you know, you need to have strength.
Yeah, because she knew he was working so hard that she just had to bring that hot dog.
Yeah, you had to also nourish your body also to continue on to have strength.
But sometimes, I have to confess to you, that sometimes I didn't sleep at all.
Oh. So this is the American dream to continue on your journey, George. George, sacrifice. You hear that, folks? Again, didn't come easy. And again, this is a different time, but still, you can see that the foundation of the willpower, the resiliency, the maturity, and the responsibility to carry on a family and to grow a family, the second child, and of course growing the family more and more. Because again, George, you came off the ship, you made a commitment, you will go back. You don't want to disappoint your family. I'm going back to your original comment you made earlier. You do not want to disappoint your family back in Italy. And I know you have also siblings in Italy, also during this time, right?
Three.
Yeah, three. Or four. No, three. I'm sorry, three. And so you have also similar responsibilities that you have to support them, because now at this point, I believe your mom and dad passed away, right? Papa, mama.
My mom passed away in 47.
40. Okay.
My father in 52.
Okay.
So while I was here, then that happened.
Yeah.
And
okay.
That was just.
Okay. And so this brought you also to be more motivated, right? More achieving that American dream. I know we're repeating this over and over again.
And you know, I have to interrupt you.
Sure.
But Marie is a saint, true and true. You know, she always sent money to my family. You know, $10 a month, $20 a month. But she took it away from our children to send money home to my family. You know? All the time. For years and years, she never stopped.
Beautiful, Marie.
She used to make packages of of used clothing.
Clothing.
And then ship it.
Yeah, you know, just you know, in the
things you don't hear today.
Just
amazing, Marie. See,
yeah.
the sacrifice and the love of you done all right now, yeah. And it shows. It shows the beautiful family. I'm sitting down, folks. You can't see it, but now I'm sitting down all around this room, also pictures of grandchildren, doing pictures, photos, and just the things around, pictures of God. I mean, all these beautiful things. You can see the love and happiness that all of them have here. So, George, I want to make this, again, for those who are listening, folks, I hope you're appreciating this. So, what George is saying, what Marie is saying, love will conquer all. Sacrifice will conquer all.
That's true.
Because you have to work hard. You know, again, how you react and how you respond to the events of your life always will equal the outcome. And there's a formula, folks, so those of you who have been listening to my podcast in the past, E plus R equals O. It's a formula of success. E represents the events of your life. The events that happen to your life, how we respond. How we respond to those events by your belief system, by your imaginary love and who you are, what you are, will always equal your outcome. And this is a perfect example of the outcome that these two have shared. So, George, now I'm going to take this from Drexel. You start working. You start getting some kind of corporate operations also. You're all sacrificing. Tell us more about now. You graduated. Eventually, you graduated, right?
62.
Now, this Drexel company gave you an opportunity to work with some companies that
Drexel
today...
University
now, okay. This work that you've done in physics...
Well, you know, I took everything that I could get to get into Drexel. So they said the only opening that we have, because that was during... You know, the Sputnik era where Eisenhower needed a lot of engineers.
Let's hear that. Exactly. During that year, America wants to also kind of get to the space and
there
moon.
There was a race to equal the, you know, the Russians. And so, you know, everybody wanted engineers at that time. So Drexel was an exponent in Philadelphia of engineering. And the only openings that they had were metallurgical engineering. So I take whatever, you know.
Sounds Greek to me, metallurgical engineering.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Balance, you know?
Yeah.
And, but after about 9 months ago, I was there, you know, started talking to the younger kids, you know, in the school. and everybody was saying, you know, the toughest course in the school is physics. And I said, I couldn't resist it.
So then you shift now gears into...
I couldn't resist it. And then I put in for physics, and the dean of engineering said, if you get 85 or better in math and sciences, for two consecutive terms,
they'll put you in.
We'll consider you.
Oh, consideration.
Yeah.
And?
So it happened that... 8 months later, you know, in the school there, the way you communicated in those days was that you had a little mailbox for everybody, every student.
Yeah.
And so you checked the mailbox every day, right? For news.
Okay.
And so got the mailbox, present yourself to the dean of engineering.
Uh-oh, what did you do now? All right.
You know, the first thing that came to my mind,
the
immigration.
Oh, back to the immigration.
Now, and they found out that I don't have 16 and a half credits, only 15 and a half.
From the equivalency of the...
Right, so they're going to throw me out of school. That was either that or they ship me back to Italy and I have, you know...
Oh, no, not again.
And I have...
And
at that time, was the most... Marie was pregnant. My mommy was pregnant at that time, right? So So in any case, I go to Dean, you know, and there was this statue there that everybody touches the toe. And you go up.
I read that. It was essentially shiny also, right?
Anthony Drexler, the founder of Drexler University. And so he just, you know,
rubbed.
Touched it and I said, God, please, you know, Anthony. So I went into the room, his office, and I was just frantic, you know.
Sure. You know, you were nervous and sweaty palms German, and whatnot.
In right? German, they say, Das Endung, you know, the end. Oh. The end, I said. Yeah, they were teaching me German in the practice, so it was great.
Wow.
And,
got it.
But someone in there said, Skalko, come here. And I said, oh, my Lord.
And you were thinking the worst.
Oh, my. I said, that's, I'm expelled. You know, I can't cut it. I'm going back to Italy.
Still, and, in 19, what year is this now? 1960?
That was,
oh,
no,
50,
no. Yeah. That was 1957, 58.
The
end of 58.
Okay.
The end of 58.
So still you're not in the clear yet.
And we still did not have, remember I said before, if you did not have make enough money to pay for your own trip, then you went back as a prisoner. So we still didn't have enough money set aside to do that, wow, because we used it up for the school.
Sure.
So I said, yeah, this is absolutely it. You know? But, and he said, Skalko, you're accepted in the physical curriculum.
Great, and celebration, said, wow.
Oh my God! You know, that's, yeah. And I, you know, as soon as the school was over, I ran home. I said, Marie, guess what? I'm about to be a physicist, you know, and, so
and then
Marie cried, and
the father goes, physicist. I go to physicist every month.
Yeah, that's right. Take a physical.
Physical.
Epsom salt.
Epsom salt. Wow. So great news for that. You feel more relief, and that's another milestone, right? That was another milestone
it
for you.
It was, but now physics comes, you know, and he said, the dean said, you realize that physics is. So he sent me immediately to the dean of physics. So I went. Eugene Ware, and he was a tall man with glasses, you know, very extremely serious, you know, just
very stern,
almost stoic, yeah. You know, just
stoic.
And they said, sit down there, that's okay. And he said, well, he said, you know, physics. I said, you know, I learned so many times that you better tell the truth, you know. Tell the truth. I said, no, you know, I had a course in physics, but I know very little about physics. You know. I said, I had a semester and a half. I said, well, I said, if you really like it, you're going to have to work as hard as you never have before in your life. So remember, you're going to have math every term from now until you graduate. Every term you're going to have some type of math. And it's going to get increasingly difficult, you know, complex variables.
Sure.
And it was
all Greek to me.
Oh, my Lord. So that was, and then I started there and went to American Viscose in Marcosoc to work every 6 months.
So that's an American company already established.
That was in Marcosoc.
That was located in Philadelphia?
No, it was outside. It was a little south of Philadelphia, right on the river, on the Delaware River.
Okay.
By where it is now, the Delaware Memorial Bridge. So it was down that way. So
okay.
It was Marcosoc. It's a very, very small town, and it was a factory town. American Viscose.
And so
there.
you were there as an apprentice, I guess, doing work.
I was a co-op student.
Co-op student, okay. And here you got your feet wet. You got learning also.
Oh my God.
Okay. So now let's fast forward now. Here we have that going on. So as you move forward, also you graduated eventually, right?
And yep. They gave me a job immediately.
Immediately. Yes. With what company? Same company?
Yeah, American Viscose. They said stay here.
And what were you doing there? What was?
They called me. A research physicist.
So you did a little researching and doing...
Only research.
Research, okay.
Only research.
Let's fast forward now. From research to also now you go to now... How did you get to the next level? What was the next step and how long would that happen?
Well, I have to tell you that the people on my map there, they were doing basic research, okay, and development.
Of what?
A lot of polymers because
okay,
it was
there
a textile company. But then they were very broad-minded. They just did stuff... they did they were trying, actually, one of the projects was to find as to whether we could make semiconductors out of some sort of a plastic, because semiconductors, you know, are made out of silicon, and they're very, very difficult to make, high temperatures, all kinds of things.
So this is at the beginning of this whole new era of research and development in technology that we have today.
Mm-hmm. But of course now I know that it would be impossible to make a semiconductor out of plastic, you know, because it's just impossible. But they wanted to do that, so I started studying some systems, polymeric systems, even biological systems, because sometimes they behave in some ways like semiconductors, you know. Yeah.
And you're getting very deep now as a scientist, yeah. A physicist also.
So there was a bunch of chemists making stuff.
Okay.
And then on the other side was mostly physicists, but a great combination.
That's where you were, right? Okay. So there, you did your thing, right? And everything else.
But the people were so, they were, you know, I came across people that I didn't know existed. You know, they just, they were always dressed well, they were always courteous, they always spoke well, they were always kind to you, they were always helpful.
So,
you know, just
this was all now part of your plan now. It's now.
It wasn't a plan. It was.
Hold on.
It was serendipity, I think it was.
Oh, well, but you know what? And you're taking action. And you're creating this platform, this road, this roadway. And I can see it happening. So now,
I think that God found me, you know, I really do.
Well, it's the spiritual guidance, is definitely, that's why the faith comes into place, right? Faith, spiritual faith, right? We believe in God.
Well, I have to tell you this, you're probably not going to like it. But when I started studying physics, I actually abandoned my religion.
Apparently, in my world of life, you hear also those who are coming into sciences also have now a comparison or starts adjudicating the fact of the spiritual God, energy, and so on and so forth. I understand.
So I was away from the church for 10 years before I came back with the help of Marie. You know,
okay. There you go. There goes Marie again.
I went to church.
Yeah, that's it.
She was very religious, Marie.
So now you fast forward. So you had this company here. You moved forward. You got promoted, I'm sure, right? And all that there.
I graduated, I got promoted to research.
So what are the other things that you've done up to until you retired?
I can't do that. I have to tell you, the angels in my life, you know.
So from American, American company?
The American business, I met a gentleman named Frank Patton. And,
he was a wonderful...
I can't describe him as to how good he was. He was religious, he was a great physicist, a great researcher. And he and Doug Keith, a gentleman who worked with him, he was the department head from England, Scott, it was Scott. And they left American Viscose about a year after I graduated.
Okay.
They were invited to go to Bell Laboratories in Murray Hill, New Jersey.
Okay, Bell Laboratories.
Bell Laboratories at that time was the premier, the absolute premier laboratories, research laboratory in the world.
There you go. Sure.
It was part of AT&T.
Yeah.
And there was a lot, you know, there was about 40,000 people. So the research, most of the things that we have today, you know, that you take for granted, telephones and satellites, I'm not exaggerating.
No.
Most of it came from there, you know, the basic science.
Came from Bell Labs.
Bell Labs.
That is, okay.
So they had a lot of satellites, you know, but like the Big Bang Theory.
I gotcha.
Everybody knows about it, okay? So my boss's boss, Arnold Penzias.
Okay.
Arnold Penzias, a wonderful Jewish or Greek descent, you know, I used to call him the cream cheese and bagel guy, because every time he went to his office, which was once a year, he would give you bagels and cheese, or a little bagel. So
okay. I love bagels, by the way. I miss the bagels. I come from New York, and I live in North Carolina. I miss bagels.
Yeah. But he's the one, with a fellow by the name Johnson, formulated the Big Bang Theory. Would you believe that?
Okay.
And while I was, in any case, so they were invited to go to Bell Labs. They accepted it. And then, after a half a year, Frank Patton called me up and he said, "We would like it to come to Bell Labs."
And then you were where now? Again,
in American Viscose.
Okay, there you go. Okay.
And I said,
"And you accepted?"
No, I didn't.
Oh.
You know, I had a family, you know.
Oh, well.
So we had two children, and one on the way.
Ah, oh, no, the third one coming on the way. There you go. We're getting there.
Right. So, and I thought, you know, Marie, God bless her, man. She always, 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 always said yes to me. All the times. It's the first time she said no.
Oh.
No moving. I cannot leave my mother here. Her mother, you know, Louis, Marie's father passed away in 72. 62. The year, he actually never seen me graduate.
Oh.
Believe that? So he passed away.
I'm sure he's looking down right now on this conversation right now and giving you a blessing right
I'm
now.
I'm sure he's done that a lot.
Yes.
Yeah. He's done that a lot. Yeah. While he was taking Epsom salts.
Again, yeah. Hey, there you go. Hey, you can still chuckle up there and send out good vibes.
He does it every morning. Every time he comes down, he takes the Epsom salt.
Once a month.
Yeah. Okay. I guess I'm gonna start taking Epsom salt too.
And then he goes down the cellar.
Yeah.
And he says his prayer. So my brother. Died.
Who got killed in the World War II?
Oh,
yes.
Sorry.
And then sits down on a step in the house like this. And his wife was coming down.
Yeah.
And she says, Louie, what are you doing? And then all of a sudden, went down. And I turned him over. And he died.
Oh.
Sad.
Well, folks, you see a lot of emotions here, and we could continue on and on and on for hours and hours and hours here. You hear the stories, you hear the emotions right now on this podcast that Marie is sharing the story. These are family events which are near dear to our hearts. And we want to continue on, a journey and learn from this, you know. So families are listening to, if you're young, old, whatever, like I said earlier at the beginning, you are 15 years old, 20 years old, 25, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years old. We're all human beings and we have emotions. And of course, our sacrifices are not overlooked. And George, if I may, you went forward with Bell Labs, right? It's understood with AT&T. You moved to California. You sacrificed. You did that back and forth also, right?
Yeah, as I was saying, Bell Labs was part of the research arm of AT&T. And then I accepted as a finding Marie. Agreed to come, you know, she said, after I have my baby, I'll come up.
And, there you go.
The baby was born in March 8th of 1964.
Huh?
But we did go to Bell Labs, and you have no idea. When I went there, there were four Nobel Prize winners on the same floor where I worked.
So you were right in the thick of things, George.
Yeah.
Because your pathway led you there. Again, your response, your reactions were taking exactly where you need to be. How did you feel by then? What was your emotions by then as you got to this?
I felt that I didn't deserve it. I really didn't.
You still were denying that you didn't deserve it?
I didn't deserve it because, you know, I was a poor student when I was a kid. I was not I was a great student at Drexel, but the results, I didn't get the best grades. You know,
you had to work hard. Let's put it this way.
Work hard. I mean, you have no idea as to, you know, just it was day and night. And Marie was so patient. She would never see me. You know, I go home, I go right back to the little room, and then I go wait on tables and this and that. So I was, you know, can you imagine having four Nobel Prize winners on the same floor? And you said, what am I doing here? You know, I'm misplaced.
And
right?
The pressure was onto you, right? The pressure was on.
Yeah, but I had one of the lowest jobs there. It was almost like I was back in the shop. So I was...
High ironic, that is.
Even though I had a degree, they called me a senior technical aide.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. I thought it was a good title until I found out that it was almost the lowest guy on the ship again, you know? But you know what? Again, I found... Angel after angel after angel, you know, the people, the projects, you have no idea the stuff that was going on there,
so,
unimaginable.
Let me kind of group this together. You worked with many, many projects. You grew in the experience. They gave you some higher positions. I understand you were the director. You had to move to California. You're back again. And you had to make a lot of decisions. Let's put it this way, right? And now you come and you move to this Carolina, as I understood, a company called Raycam, right?
Yes, sir.
And then, of course, you were director. You were hiring people. You were the main person, right?
Yes.
Ah, not really.
Well, you are in your...
In the technical sense.
Well, okay, and that's a big accomplishment. Would you say at this point you accomplished quite a bit with now four children, wife, moving back and forth, you know, getting grander?
I would say that I accomplished more than I ever did.
You're very humble.
I mean, just not in a serious
way. George, you're very humble, I have to say.
No. I'm really so serious, you have no idea.
Okay.
I think I never thought I could do that, but you know, without Marie and the support of the family, and all of the friends and angels that we found on the way, you know, all over, anywhere we went to, there was always somebody helping us. You know, we thought we were helping them. No, they weren't. You know, they were just always kind people. So, of all of my American experience, I only found one person that did me wrong. But out of all of these years, can you imagine that?
Well,
how lucky can you be, right?
No, well, you are loved, you are cherished, and also what I hear, and I met you a very short period of time offline here, and that's why I'm here, taking my time also to sit down in your home, your lovely home with lots of love, lots of beautiful memories here, to record this interview and to share the story. A long story, I mean, but I still want the folks to buy a book now, okay? They have to go out to the book, and I'm gonna put the link on the podcast show, so you can click on the link.
Also, I want to thank you for this a lot, because...
You see, it's reciprocity. It's what you give. It's what, the more you give out there, the more you do, things come to you. It's karma. You know, Lord, God, Jesus, you know, energy, supernatural also, there's a force here. And what we heard today is the level of being and giving, right? And so there's no way that these things happen by accident. And again, like I say, you're very humble in the things that you're saying, the things that you're doing, you know, it's still do today.
I feel that way.
You know, and you go to the gym. I mean, when is anyone right now, almost 90 years, as this recording, folks, Mr. George is celebrating his 90th birthday in August 20th, right? All right, so again, when this becomes public out there, he's going to the gym. I called him last week. He goes, oh, he's in the gym. Hold on 1 second. I'm at the gym. Wow. You motivated me, George. I have to go to the gym. Anyway, it's not about me. It's about the story here today. Now you're here in Carolina. You retired also. I understand you also do some volunteer work. I'm going to fast forward here because it says we have truly, truly want them to read the book. The way it hit me also, it has to also affect them as well. Any additional family and friends. So just tell us right now, what do you do now? How do you keep yourself busy?
Well, my main aim in life now is to take care of Marie.
Yep.
And to be good to our family.
Excellent.
To bring the Eucharist to any Catholic who's ill.
You have a ministry in your local church,
I coordinate five nursing homes.
Oh.
And go to the hospital and to the homebound, and so we try to do as best we can, you know, because there are always people in need, and so God gave me the strength to continue this. So, but the main purpose right now is to be here with Marie, take care of her as well as I can. And be good to our family.
Absolutely, and continue, and good example for the family and friends and your community. And you want to do a little plug in how we met, because this is how because I didn't have an opportunity. I didn't know you until a few months ago. How do we meet, George?
Well, it was a great meeting because he says, "I'm Ruggiero." I said, "Ruggiero." I've been here for 70 years in this country. It's the first time I met somebody by name Ruggiero, because I have a younger brother by 9 years, you know.
Oh.
By 9 years, by name Ruggiero. And I told you before that my father got torpedoed during the war, and he was in the water for 32 hours. And he came home from that, and 9 months to the day, after he came home to us, was born Ruggiero.
Wow, it's an honor. I know I've not very people know the name Ruggiero also as well. So, but we belong to an organization which you also part of also.
That's called the Sons of Italy.
Yes.
So now it's called this Sons. The
triangle.
Triangle.
Sons
and daughters of Italy. We added the daughters recently. So
okay.
Which is great.
And this is a lounge, a lodge here at 2817, right?
Yes. And then there is another club that we belong to. It's called Tiaja. We said that before.
I heard about that.
Triangle Heritage Home Association. And there are two fine organizations, and I'm an officer in.
Oh, you are?
Two of them.
Yeah. And you part of the Knights of Columbus also?
Oh, I'm a fourth degree.
There you go. I want to hear that too. So even that keeps you also busy ongoing as you're taking care of Marie also, your spouse here.
And we do Eucharistic ministry for the altar too. We do that.
Okay.
And we go to Mass on Sunday, every Sunday. And most of the times the local family is here with us. And then our grandson Michael comes on with us with Beatrice and her husband Tim. And sometimes our great-granddaughters.
Yeah.
And Michael cooks breakfast for us. And he's fantastic.
That's awesome.
Fantastic.
Maybe you have to come.
Beatrice's son.
Maybe I have to come and join you one day.
Please
yeah,
do.
You're welcome.
Okay.
You're welcome anytime.
Thank you. It's Beatrice. She's invited me already. So I'm invited. I'm part of the family now. It's okay. La famiglia. Io adesso mi chiamo Ruggiero. Sono Ruggiero. In English, you know how they translate.
Roger.
I know. Yes. I know. So back in Italy, I just came back. My friends from Italy, childhood friends also go, Roger. You know, in Paese, you know, they call me, of course, you know, it, Roger. And like, you know, my wife goes, they call you Roger here? I say, yeah, because when they came here, they want to make the English, the American thing, you know.
Yeah. Well, Mikey, welcome.
Is she Italian?
Yeah. You know, my wife, no, she's not Italian. She's Sicilian.
It's a special Italian.
Oh, my God.
I know. I told my father-in-law.
Very, very special. Sicilians are very, very special.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart also as well. I
have to tell you quickly, I respect Sicilians because that's where the unification of Italy started.
That's
from,
right.
In 1865.
I learned that just recently. We're going to Palermo with my Vita's aunt. She's a teacher in Palermo, and she's a scholar, and she shared that information. I had no idea. Sicily was the, yes.
If I can chime in.
Yes, you can.
Giuseppe Garibaldi, who was a general,
that's
who
right.
helped to unite Italy, because Italy was fractured into little states.
Yes.
But some of the money, believe it or not, Americans, came from America.
Amen. So, that being said, do you like people?
Yes.
like we say in the South, I love people.
And you like meeting people, right?
Yes.
I love people, yes.
You do?
So do I.
And that's how you met me also.
I couldn't live without meeting people every day.
And that's why you keep yourself busy in the community. You're a role model, and you continue to be a role model, and with the family you have around you here as well.
I don't know about that.
Well, I believe so. So I'm going to ask you a question here. We're going to just sum up here, because this has been a wonderful, wonderful interview, wonderful conversation. We went from different angles, but yet we're coming to a conclusion here. Not a conclusion, but a continue on of a journey. What's a word or a phrase or a short commentary? What would you want to say to the audience out there? What words of wisdom would you want to give to someone who's listening to this right now and has listened to this now over nearly 2 hours now? What were the words? Think about it for a second.
I'll say a few words.
Go ahead.
I'm not going to think about it because it's very extremely easy to do. I think that first of all, don't ever be afraid of work and working hard, and I mean very hard, because that makes you noble, it makes you feel noble, it makes your family feel noble, it makes God feel noble, and not be afraid of anything, because with patience and perseverance you could conquer anything. And I mean,
can you repeat that again? With what?
You could conquer perseverance and whatever courage means. I don't know how to define that, but I think courage comes many times with need. You know, as we say in South Philly, you need what you have to do. You do what you have to do. Because if you don't do it, no one is going to do it. Now, there was a gentleman who used to be a paper hanger in Germany. His name was Hitler.
Yes.
And he said to the Germans, I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to do that for you. I'm going to do that for you. And guess what? He took over and he did nothing for nobody. He just killed people. So you do it yourself and just help others as much as you can. And it makes you feel so good.
Rewarding, right? Very yes. Rewarding.
Yeah.
Well, Marie, would you like to say a few words as we conclude here? What would you say your experience was to meet this beautiful man and to your journey? What would you say?
Once I got to know him.
Get a little closer to the microphone. Go ahead.
My man here.
My man. All right. Yeah. My man.
I have been very lucky to be with him. He's very nice, and I love him.
So you would say waving at the window while he's making pizza, as he said, looking like a monkey in the window.
Yeah, I did.
But you went back and forth in that block, the round block, and you were a boy to him. You walked across the street, back and forth. But look where you are today. We'll be celebrating very shortly 70 years.
Where?
Next year.
Right?
Married.
Yeah. Married. Next year, right?
Oh,
so.
Yeah.
Well, X Factors to Success, folks out there, you are listening to the G Man here, Ruggiero, with two wonderful, or three, I may say, wonderful people, human beings in front of me. They have shared with me today and shared with you today. If you're listening this month of August, 2023, you're listening another year from now. If you capture this, because obviously it's a leap of faith. That's the title of this podcast. You know, off the boat, or again, jumping boat, jumped ship, leap of faith. It's very relevant. If you learn a few things today, share this podcast, share the show with your family and friends. If you have also some older family members in your midst, try to forward them this podcast, be available on different platforms. Let them listen to it. Let them sit back and listen to this journey, to this story. Because it's definitely from a romance novel right now. It could be a show that you could watch and put some tears into your eyes and show some resiliency as far as what life can bring to you when you work hard, you work smart. Sometimes, and it's not even being smart, but being very courageous. And the fact that, you know, courage is a key ingredient of achieving success. You know, faith, family and friends, fitness, finance and fun, those things are key foundations of the foundation of life, foundation of fulfilling. And of course, for George and Emery and the family, it's the American dream. You know, again, money doesn't grow on trees. You know, people say, but it's the fact that you're working hard. So George, I want to thank you very much from the bottom of my heart of your openness, your genuine love, but you shed tears today. And I know that you did with all heart. And I know even your daughter, Beatrice, sitting here, your first child here, of all the years of sacrifice you've done, and your beautiful wife also sharing her emotions and her family and whatnot. It's what makes America all about. And again, this podcast, whoever's listening to it, if you're in a different part of the country, different part of the world, because everyone can listen to this. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Rudero. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Beatrice, as well. So folks, you heard that. And until next time, I'm going to bring another guest very soon. And this one just tops every show that I produced. So I love you all. Don't forget to live with purpose, live with passion, and have a dream. Have a dream of passion. Have a dream to fulfill the needs for your family. And that's the key foundation. God bless you. And until next time.